welcome to the October 19, 2020 meeting of Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for attending and remind you that due to COVID restrictions, we are holding this meeting virtually, and we would ask you to mute your phone until such time you wish to speak. Today's meeting is a study and business session with the study session starting this morning at 10 a.m. and the afternoon business session starting at 1 p.m. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. And if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask you to unmute your phone. Say that 10 times fast. And please state your name and address for the record. And limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have all five commissioners present. General Manager Steve Wright, Acting General Counsel Katie Young. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you.
And Rebecca Garvin, Clerk of the Board.
To an automatic voice message system, 5096684169 is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Are we still there?
I think we are.
I'm here.
I'm here. There.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
That was different.
And so I'm not sure what happened there, but we would like to welcome Vicki Griffin in leading the Pledge of Allegiance and a Human Performance Initiative Minute. Are you there, Vicki?
I'm here. Thank you. I pledge allegiance
Go ahead.
To the flag of the United
States.
America,
to the republic
for which it stands,
for which
one
it
nation,
stands,
under God,
nation,
indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all.
So I'm Vicki Griffin, and I'm the manager of the Real Estate and Permitting Department. And today I have our safety minute, and it's related to driving in the dark. As we near daylight savings time, we're all going to be doing a little bit more of that, and they've determined that this is the most dangerous time to drive at night. So as we fall back to shorter days, we should take extra caution on the care on the road. Shorter days, fatigue, compromised night vision, rush hour, and impaired drivers all contribute to making driving at night more dangerous than any other time of day. According to research by the National Safety Council, the risk of a fatal crash is 3 times greater at night. When daylight saving time starts near this year at 2 a.m., November 1st, many of us will find ourselves spending more time driving in the dark. Depth perception, color recognition, and peripheral vision can be compromised in the dark, and the glare of headlights from an oncoming vehicle can temporarily blind a driver. Even with high-beam headlights on, visibility is limited to about 500 feet, and that's only 250 feet for normal headlights, creating less time to react to something on the road, especially when driving at higher speeds. So how can we be safer while driving in the dark? Check the alignment of your headlights and make sure they're clean. Your auto repair shop can do this for you, or if you're a do-it-yourselfer, there are instructions in your car's manual, or you can ask the world's foremost authority on, well, everything, Google. Make sure your dashboard lights are dimmed, look briefly away from oncoming lights, and if you wear glasses, make sure they're anti-reflective. Clean the windshield to eliminate streaks and slow down to compensate for limited visibility and reduce stopping time. And let's all be safer this winter as we start driving a little bit more in the dark. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Vicki. Great points. Appreciate that good information. So we'll move on to approval of the agenda. Commissioners, we have been presented an agenda. Items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear of any such requests, additions, or changes to the agenda?
So I'd like to suggest moving item 9 from the regular agenda to the consent agenda. Per recommendation from management.
Thank you, Randy. Do we have any other changes? Tame, I'll take a motion to accept the change to the agenda as amended.
I would so move.
Do I have a second?
I'll second.
I have a second.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 509-668-4169 is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
So can we figure out who 4169 is? Commissioners, we're not sure what's happening there, so we're going to try to figure that out. Hopefully we can get a hold of whoever is using the phone in that way. We don't recognize the number.
The number again? Yeah, I don't recognize the number.
Hmm. What was that number?
It ends in 4169.
If you are satisfied with your message, press 1 to listen to your message. Press 2 to erase and re-record. Press 3 to continue recording where you left off. Press 4. Are you still there? If you are satisfied with your message, press 1 to listen to your message. Press 2 to erase and re-record. Press 3 to continue recording where you left off. Press 4.
Hello, is anybody there?
Should we all try to call in to start everything over? I don't know.
This is Gary. I'm using a Wi-Fi network. Let me hang up, and I will try calling in the event of this meeting.
Commissioner, we don't. It's we think we've identified that it's someone trying to reach Dave Nelson, which I would guess is not you. So I don't know that it is you.
So this is Steve. It actually dropped me off the call, so I called back in. Anybody have a suggestion on, should we just continue?
I think we'll give it one more try, and if not, then we probably will try to restart the call, see if we can get through this.
So I was in the process of, we were in the process of voting to amend the agenda. Did we finish that?
No, that was not
finished. We haven't voted.
Oh.
So let's go ahead and pick up where we left. Sorry, Ann, I didn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 509-668-4169 is not available.
Commissioners, we would like to attempt to start over again here. So we would like to close this call, and if you would call back in on the same line, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Would it be someone on the call trying to call Dave Nelson? I mean,
yeah, so why? But how would they not know that?
They're calling.
Yeah, I just don't understand how it. But why does it, I mean, why would it keep redialing?
Welcome to the Audio Conferencing Center. Please enter a After the tone, please record your name and then press pound. You are now joining the meeting as an unknown participant.
That's me. It's Gary, I'm back.
Welcome, Gary.
I'm back.
Okay, we can hear you good. Do we have other commissioners on the line?
Dennis is on.
Great. Welcome, Dennis.
Ann's on.
Welcome, Ann.
I think the only one we're missing is Randy.
Okay, there's Steve. Good. Commissioner Smith, have you joined us?
Randy's back.
Oh. There he goes.
Terrific. Okay.
Hey. I think we have everybody. We're back online. So at this time, Steve, I'm going to turn the agenda over to you.
Okay. I just want to check and make sure we followed the protocol. We had enough going on there that I wasn't confident of that. So there was a motion to move agenda item 9 to the consent agenda. I didn't actually hear the vote, so could we just confirm the vote on that?
Certainly. So all those in favor of the vote of modifying the agenda, please notify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Great. Thank you, Commissioners. Appreciate that. So our first item today is we do have Cycle of Personal Ownership winner recognition, and this one is a fun one for us. We have not wanted to do groups for Cycle of Personal Ownership because it's about personal accountability, it's about individuals stepping up. But we have a unique situation here. This has been obviously a very unusual year with COVID, particularly a difficult year for customer relations. We made a decision early on back in March to close our lobbies, and that put a burden on our customer relations staff because they were dealing with everything by phone. And then on top of that, of course, we moved to remote work, and so we were asking folks to be able to accomplish their jobs as much as possible from home. And for the customer relations staff, they've been managing both by being in the office and by working from home. This year, they have had basically 20% more calls, which is 5,000 more calls than they've had in previous years. And I just have to note that our customers are generally willing to reach out if they have concerns, and that certainly my email is on every newsletter, and I know that they have commissioners' emails as well. And we are not receiving complaints about the service. Even though we've gone to a different type of service, we're hearing just impressive performance by our folks in terms of managing to maintain a high level of customer satisfaction, which is our most important duty around here. So we wanted to take a moment to recognize Carrie Wendell, Anna Aguirre, Megan Rose, Shaylee Childress, Jamie Torson, Amy Sims, Doug Lewis, Melissa Schwab, Frank Sanchez, Chuck Holland, Bart Miller, Cynthia Alcala, and Pat O'Hara for really the tremendous work that they have done, and to say thank you to them. With that, Carrie, would you like to say anything?
Sure. Thank you, Steve, for the acknowledgement for the customer relations team. In my tenure here of 28 years, I worked with this group as a peer and in the leadership role. Taking responsibility, personal accountability with our customers is what we do and what we're trained to do. Although this group is behind the scenes and unseen by many, this year, with the challenges of COVID and bringing on the new C2M billing system, I've witnessed this group dive into uncharted territory and definitely extraordinary challenges. So I just want to say each individual on this team, whether they were on the project team, whether they were a meter reader, or those that have maintained the continuity with our customers, they've all stepped up equally and successfully. Just as our linemen are well respected for getting power on during outages, I feel that this team provides the same level of personal accountability and commitment to resolving difficult customer issues day in and day out. They never know what they're going to get each day. I also want to mention that there are dozens of areas that have supported us during this time. We couldn't have done our jobs without the support specialists in office services, the work of John Barnett in the tech shop, and how he's mitigated everything with our phone system. We also, the IT group, specifically the help desk, they've helped us out a lot, working on any issue that they run into when they're here or at home. The Citrix has been so reliable since this team is working remotely and taking calls, you know, from 8 to 5 all day long. You know, they have very reliable internet, and our services are great. So, and we're also very fortunate, too. I want to mention that John Stoll is our managing director. John knows the importance of what we do, and he supports our team with whatever we need to provide the best customer service. So, I could really go on and on, but I really appreciate the acknowledgement to this team. They've definitely stepped up and done an outstanding job over the last few months on top of what they already do.
And, Kerry, we'd invite any other member of the team if they'd like to share anything with the board.
Anyone want to speak up?
I can speak up. This is Amy Sims. Sorry. this is Amy Sims, and I have been working from home pretty much the majority of the time since we stopped with the lobbies open in March, and that's brought on a challenge for me with I have two children in school, and I've just been so grateful for all the help and understanding that all people from the PUD have given me just with the challenges of having multiple Zoom meetings, multiple things going on. I think it's important that when we're dealing with the public and dealing with their concerns, that we can also feel comfortable that our concerns and our struggles are also recognized, and you know, help is offered for us. And I just feel so grateful to work for this organization that helps us do our job well and helps us help customers well, and just appreciate that. So thank you so much for this acknowledgement. I really feel great. Thank you.
Could a commissioner make a comment?
Please do.
It was really neat to hear that report from Kerry. And one of the things that hit me over the course of when she was sharing what's gone on is it was all about team, and I was reminded that in athletics, good coaches say there's no I in team, and I didn't hear anybody of the two of them. They were all so sharing about how the team worked and how they supported each other, and that's a powerful statement about how we're organizing our work. And I just want to say thank you to everybody that's on the call and our senior management team for cultivating an environment where teams can work well like this. That's powerful. Thank you.
And, Steve, this is Ann. I'd like to make a comment, if I may.
Please do.
Pardon me?
Please do.
Please do, Ann. Thank you.
Okay. I just wanted to share that I stop in lots of times when I'm down to the PUD for a meeting or just coming in to sign papers or whatever. I come in downstairs through the, this was pre-COVID, through the customer entrance door where our customers come in and pay bills. And I do that on purpose. I go in and just say hello and usually just, hey, how's it going? What are you hearing?
You know, how are people, what are people telling you about this or that, or just to kind of get a feel for the land and what they're hearing. And then I may sit down and do a little work or do something. And I am always just amazed. I'm so impressed with how warm and genuinely friendly and welcoming all of our people are, you know, in those particular offices. And then also I'll call sometimes the main dispatch number looking for someone, and they're always so cheerful, and I always make a comment, my gosh, how do you guys do it? So thank you. Wow, the commitment is obviously there, and we're all so grateful. Thanks.
Thank you, Ann. Those are precisely my comment, my sentiments as well, and I want to thank everybody for their hard work. Thanks, Ann. Good comment. Anybody else? Okay.
Steve, this is Gary. May I say a few words?
Please do.
I just want to really give our customer service team, Carrie's group, and everyone in that group a real heartfelt thank you. I know firsthand the difficulties of trying to work from home and raise a family and have kids who aren't going to school because of COVID, and the pressures that puts on you. And that's even amplified when you have someone at home who's not doing well health-wise, and now you're a caregiver and also working from home. Tremendous amount of pressure. And at the same time, world-class customer service. I don't know how your group does it, Carrie. I'm very grateful that they do it and do it so well. Can't say thank you enough. It's very evident throughout the community how first-class our customer service folks are. But it's even more unbelievable when you realize the real-life struggles that some of us have, or some of your customer service team have, as I said, raising a family or caring for a sick loved one at the same time. So these are things that do not escape, at least this commissioner, seeing these things. And I have to tell you, I'm impressed, and I'm also extremely grateful. So thank you to every single member of the customer service support team.
You know, Gary, you reminded me, not only are they raising families, but they're teaching families. So these folks are just like many of our other customer parents who are struggling teaching their kids at home and making sure they get on their Zoom meetings. And boy, they are juggling a lot. And, you know, as it was said earlier, we're not hearing from people that they're unhappy with our service. So, again, congratulations to your team, Carrie, and pass on our good thoughts. And congratulations. Thank you.
Yeah, if I can make a comment. This is Dennis. And recently we had some new neighbors move in. And so I just, you know, asked them a question, how did the transition go? In terms of picking up service from the PUD. And both of them looked at each other and just laughed and said, the customer service, you know, was outstanding. And those rates, my gosh, we had no idea. So first impressions are everything. Great impression. Thanks for doing that. And people are happy. And that's what it's all about. You guys do a great job. Thank you.
All right. Well, if barring no other comments, I think we'll move on to our quarterly board balance scorecard status update. And commissioners, this is our item. And so I guess we will just walk down through each commissioner, starting with Commissioner Ogden, and we'll walk through our balanced scorecard. Ann, would you like to kick things off?
Sure. Although I think we're doing this by exception, so I have no I have no exceptional issues to talk about.
Okay. Dennis, do you have anything you want to?
Yeah, Dennis, this is Dennis.
Oh, excuse me.
I have no exceptions. Yeah, I have no exceptions.
Gary, I said right past you. Is there anything you'd like to share?
Nope. Thank you, Steve. No, I also have no exceptions. My category is maintain strong financial stewardship, and we'll conduct quarterly operating and financial review presented by management, board checks for adherence to budgets, long-range plans, guidelines, principles, policies, and acceptable risk levels. We have our annual target is to meet quarterly. Of course, this is the third quarter. Well, we just entered into fourth quarter. We have met three times already this year and plan to have our fourth meeting, which will keep us on track before the end of the year.
Thank you, Gary. And we've heard from Dennis. Randy, is there anything you'd like to share?
Yeah. You bet. In looking at mine, the only categories that are white, we're in the process of dealing with our budget for right today. We will have a whole lot about that. And there was one other, when we elect board officers at the end of this year, we will establish who's going to be on the audit committee. So those are the only two that are not green.
All right. And in my area, under responsible board representation, I think we're doing fairly well attending meetings during COVID challenge times. We do have an area in NWPPA, but again, challenging times with COVID, and I think we're doing a good job at representing ourselves with our different meetings, different groups. Okay, I think that is about all we have. Does anybody else have anything else to say? All right. So with that, let's move to item number five. Steve, would you like to take over?
Sure. And I'm noticing that we've got a problem with two Steves in charge here today. We're not really sure who's being referred to. But it's helpful, Commissioner McKenna, when you call me, because then I'm sure it's me that's up. We do take the next step today in terms of moving towards a 2021 budget. This is, you recall that at the last meeting we talked about the five-year business plans. This year we make the transition to 2021. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Mullins.
Thank you, Steve. And good morning, commissioners. I'm Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics. And I also have Deborah Vaughn on the phone. She's our strategic financial planning analyst, and she is, I just want to compliment the work that she's done and does annually with respect to the budget process. It's a lengthy process that we go through, certainly requires a lot of coordination, and Deborah just does a great job with that, and setting our timelines and coordinating with the business advisors and other budgeting personnel and working with the managing directors. So she'll be on the phone as well, and we'll kick it right off. So this is our 2021 budget kickoff, timeline and key assumptions. And on page two, what we're going to cover today is our purpose, timeline, guidelines, and assumptions. And we'll talk about some of our strategic goals as well as next steps. There is no board action required today. So today's focus is really transitioning from our five-year business planning process. As you heard from Steve and the managing directors who spoke about the 2021 through 2025, business plans. This is really a focus on 2021 in the annual budgeting process. This is a kickoff presentation, so we won't really get into the numbers today, but I just do want to set the table of what's to come in the next several board meetings. Next page, please. So this graphic is really our planning cycle, and it's a continuous process throughout the year. And as soon as we're through with the budget, we kick right off and get into performance planning, and we're thinking about the next year before we know it. But just really, it all starts with our mission and our vision, and certainly the approval of the strategic plan that we had last year for 2020 through 2024. As I mentioned, shortly after that, into February of this year, the senior management team got together and they took a look at what our priorities should be for this business planning session for starting in 2021. So last board meeting, you did hear from Steve on the district-wide five-year business plan and also the managing directors on their individual business unit five-year plans. And this is where we're at today with the annual budget. Like I said, it's the kickoff meeting, so although we will present some assumptions, there won't be a lot of numbers today that you'll get in the next two presentations. From that annual budget, we do develop our district-wide performance plan that you do hear reported on quarterly. And then from there, we develop our department work plans and then also our annual employee performance plan. So the purpose of this process is just to ensure that we're all aligned. Every staff member and personnel across the district is aligned with what our goals are and what our priorities should be, and it helps from a planning perspective and to keep things on track. Next page. So this is our budget timeline. On October 5th, you did hear the business planning, so that's really setting the stage for this single-year look. Today is our kickoff presentation in the second row there. And then in November, we'll come back and have two public hearings, and we'll have a lot more details and numbers around the budget that we're bringing forward for 2021. And then on December 7th, we'll come back to the board and request consideration and approval of the 2021 budget. Next page. So the 2021 budget is really developed around our business planning efforts that you heard at the last board meeting. So our customer owner satisfaction is, of course, at the top of our balanced scorecard. So our strategic initiatives and budget are put together with respect to that. Our district initiatives are identified to accomplish our strategic plan goals that we'll get into here shortly that were identified in the strategic plan. We do have a board resolution that requires our budget to include both an annual budget and a five-year financial plan that's compliant with our district financial policies. Page? I'm on page 7. So these are the strategic plan goals. 7 objectives, but 4 major goals that came out of the strategic planning process. And I won't get into a lot of details on this particular page, as you've seen this a couple of times and it was presented at the last board meeting. But just want to remind everybody as we set the budget what those goals are. So the first one is investing in assets and people, really focusing on hydro generation, distribution reliability and safety while improving our customer service through technology. Financial resilience with respect to how well we're positioned from a financial perspective and able to adapt to changing circumstances, goal number 2. Item 3 is our public power benefit and enhancing the quality of life in Chelan County. And then goal number 4 is economic development and supporting our county in job creation and growth planning while considering the district considers rates, and we want to ensure that those are stable and predictable. Next page. So just focusing on those 4 specific goals, and I'll get into a couple of bullet points with each one of those. But just to prepare you for the numbers that are to come, our capital plans for 2021 are very ambitious. And as we successfully put those forth, obviously that requires a lot of coordination efforts with the resources internally, project managers, procurement and contracting services, legal. So it's definitely becomes challenging as we put more projects in front of those folks. Just by comparison, our 2021 forecast through Q3 are early indicators that it's going to approach $190 million for a capital budget this year in 2021. And just by comparison, that's about $26 million more than what we had planned for 2020. But we do want to continue our focus on hydro capability and advancing ourselves through that first quartile in distribution reliability, and have a lot of plans around advancing our long-term planning around facilities. So you'll see those in the numbers when we bring those forth in the public hearings. 2021, we're also going to initiate advanced metering infrastructure. This will certainly increase operational efficiencies, improve our response time for outages, but will also give some insightful customer service and advice as well. From a people perspective, continuing with our, certainly one of our values, operational excellence, we want to advance and aim for that first quartile in safety and also human performance initiative. We can advance our district's safety culture, but also continue to identify and continue with operational excellence and identifying efficiencies in the right way and continuing to work safely with respect to all the projects that we have on the plate. I also want to emphasize on from a people perspective, we also have employee development plans. Every staff member at the district has an individual development plan, and it's an opportunity to annually look at what are the skills that they would like to continue to refine, gain, or continue to work on, whether it's soft skills, people skills, leadership skills, technical skills, but really providing an opportunity for our district personnel to advance in their careers. Next page. Financial resilience is another goal of ours. Certainly, this is an important one. We're a strong AA-rated entity, and we want to remain in that manner. We've put together prudent financial policy metrics through policies that were approved by the board, and we're going to put forth a budget as well as a five-year plan, of course, that we will meet and continue to meet those financial metrics. We have a strong cash balance, and this provides us flexibility to adapt to changing circumstances. And I think we saw a good example of that this year in 2020 when we had a plan of finance that came forth, and we were intending to retire some debt, but we chose not to, to maintain some additional liquidity and cash just to adapt to the uncertainty around COVID-19. So the benefits of having a low debt leverage is that we're able to do that without breaching our financial policies around debt leverage. So maintaining that low debt leverage is certainly giving us an advantage to maintaining cash balances and debt balances accordingly that helps us adapt to changing circumstances. I'll get into a few more details on the rate assumptions, but we have retail rate increases in our budget as well as our five-year plan. This is all consistent with the strategic plan and the feedback that we got from our customer owners. And one item that is changing, this will come forward in the Q3 financial update, but we have new debt forecasted in 2023 to support our capital program. This is advanced 1 year. Previously, we had reported 2022, but we do have some significant drawdowns on our cash over the next several years with the capital plans that we put forth. So right now, we're forecasting new debt in 2023 to support those efforts. Next page. So as I mentioned, we're required to bring an annual budget that's compliant with our district financial policies. I won't get into a lot of details, but liquidity, combined debt service coverage, debt ratio, and days cash on hand are all green in this budget that we'll bring forward. I would note that our liquidity target is slightly over $210 million, which is well above our $175 million. But with the magnitude of the capital and the O&M, to put this plan forward, those are increasing those liquidity targets, but we're in good financial shape to be able to do that. Next page. Goal number three, public power benefit. As you recall, in 2020, we brought forward some financial criteria that we go through annually to evaluate what we should be funding for our public power benefit. That was increased in 2020 from $4 million to $6 million annually, in our 2021 planning indicates that that financial criteria will again support continuation at that $6 million level. And those projects that we'll be bringing forward in 2021 include... Hello? Is there a comment?
I think you can proceed, Mark.
Okay. Sorry about that. I thought I heard a comment. Thank you. So the approved projects going forward under the Public Power Benefit 2021 are going to provide incremental value to the community, including the fiber expansion program that's really providing value to more people in our county, which is part of our strategic plan to provide the most for folks in our county. And also modernizing the Rocky Reach Discovery Center and Museum Story is also a public power benefit item that we'll bring forward in 2021. With respect to goal number four, economic development, the Diamond Foundry is a good example of that. They've been under operation now, but we're expecting them to ramp up more so towards their 19 average megawatts. They're still quite a ways from that. I'll provide some additional details on that in a second, but they're expected to ramp up their load in 2021. There's always an opportunity for additional expansion down the road. Significant work on the distribution substations and other infrastructure. We want to be able to support, not only address the capacity needs of our substations, but also be able to support the load growth in our community. And the third bullet, we want to position our portfolio in a manner where we can adapt to changing circumstances with respect to new large loads. We did see that with cryptocurrency. We thought we might have a significant large load coming. The Diamond Foundry is another example. So we want to prepare our portfolio in a manner that allows us to adapt to those changing profiles and new loads that may be coming, but also paying attention to our stable and predictable rates while supporting those additional loads. Next page. So with external indicators is something that we do look at. It's somewhat the known unknowns that we look at, but also indications that we're getting from areas outside of the district. One of the big ones for this year that we hadn't experienced in the past is COVID-19. So that uncertainty certainly remains, and I know numbers are increasing, certainly not just here, but also across the states. So that uncertainty is going to continue to be with us. But we want to continue to bring those investments forward and do so in a safe manner, which we've proven to do in 2020, and we'll continue to do so in 2021. We want to bring those investments forward that provide the highest long-term customer owner value. With respect to uncertainty, the one thing certain about wholesale market prices is that they will be volatile. While we've seen a lot of movement with respect to where we are at last year's budget, we saw prices just north of 28 when we set the budget. We saw those go down to the low 20s as we move through the year in 2020, and they've come up a little bit. But we're certainly seeing 2021 to be a little bit better, but overall over the five-year horizon, just a little bit lower, as you saw in the five-year business plan. So that's one thing that we can be certain of, is they will be volatile and they will move. But one of the attributes of our hydro generating plants is the capacity and carbon prices are attributes that are unique to those units, certainly, and those facilities, and those prices are strengthening. So that's a good sign. Technology is both an opportunity and a risk. We've seen that with cybersecurity needs that's continuing to advance, and we have some robust efforts to keep the district one step ahead of the bad actors out in the world today with respect to cybersecurity, but we are addressing those. And technology provides a lot of opportunities as well, as you've seen in the technology roadmaps and better understanding our operations through technology. And we are focusing on being a leader in this area. As I mentioned on system load growth, we need to build that flexibility because changes in customer profiles do happen. We get inquiries on large loads on occasion. We want to be prepared to be able to serve those loads. So we want to have that ability to adapt as needed. And over Labor Day weekend, we certainly saw wildfire risk remains. California has had another tough year, but we certainly experienced here in the Northwest. Northwest and Washington and Oregon and other areas. The insurance premiums that we brought forward last year saw some significant increases. We're expecting to see those again. But we are expanding our risk mitigation efforts and spending more money on our vegetation management program and putting the right actions in place from a risk mitigation efforts around wildfire. Next page. So we'll real quickly get into the 2021 budget assumptions, hitting on some key areas. Wholesale revenue, as always, we budget for average water, our current forage energy prices, as well as carbon price curves. We'll incorporate that into the budget assumptions. Our hedge program, I'd like to note, is fully implemented in 2021, so that's a huge benefit when it comes to declining prices, be able to hedge that portfolio in the manner that we have, and it also protects against low water as well as operational risk. We do consider our planned unit outage impacts when we forecast our generation, as well as considering the requirements around hydro fish spill. From a system load growth perspective, as I mentioned, the Diamond Foundry is a big driver this year with roughly 6 average megawatts of increasing load in 2021. Overall, about 7.8 average megawatts total, net of conservation across the district, or 3.8% increase. Just under 1% of that is considered to be organic growth. On the water and wastewater, we're assuming 2% and 1.5% respectively, and we're forecasting to bring in just under 1,500 new fiber connections, of which 350 of those are related to the public power benefit program. I mentioned we have our rate increase assumptions consistent with our long-term rate plan. We are planning our first rate increase on 12-1 of 2020 and then planning to implement those annually from there with the next one coming after December of this year, coming in June 1st of 2021. And then we'll increase those rates on June 1st thereafter. Just as a reminder, we have a 3% rate increase for the electric business as well as fiber, and 4% for water and wastewater. On the labor bargaining units, we're in the last year of our collective bargaining agreement, so we don't have those negotiations final at this point in time, but we do have a placeholder consistent with the previous agreement in place for the budget assumptions. On the non-bargaining unit, those are really informed by actual market data. So we do have some placeholder assumptions for merit increases, market adjustments, as well as promotions. From our cost-plus power contract, similar to what we brought forward last year, our debt reduction charge and capital recovery charge are set at 3% and 50% rates going into 2021. Next page. So the capital and operating expenditures will bring forward numbers that are significant for the 2021 budget. This is really driven by our 2021 through 2025 business plans that you saw at the last board meeting to support our strategic plan. And just highlighting a couple of the expenditure items that are significant, certainly the Rock Island modernization, the continued work at the hydros, but also at Rocky Reach around our Rocky Reach small units, and the large unit repairs that will advance that a little bit forward, but continuing to work on those units. Distribution infrastructure with substations, but also spending more money on vegetation management to mitigate wildfire risk, as I mentioned. But a lot of effort around in capital and O&M efforts around facilities, service center, Rocky Reach and Central Maintenance, as well as Rock Island, are all key drivers in the 2021 budget. On the debt side, we have net scheduled principal payments of $111 million, but I would like to note that this does include $85 million of a debt retirement that we chose not to do last year to maintain liquidity, to give us more flexibility with COVID-19 uncertainty. So our plan in the budget is to retire that debt in 2021, and our interest earnings are estimated at 2.17%. On the public power benefit program, as mentioned, the 2021 criteria supports a $6 million annually into the forecast and also at the assumption for the 2021 budget. And this does include continuation and acceleration of the fiber expansion program. The board approves the funding as well as the selected projects, and budget revisions will be processed as those new projects are designated. So with that, our next steps, we've been really continuing. As I mentioned, the planning cycle is a year-long process. We've gone through the business planning process, and right now in parallel, we are moving forward with really fine-tuning the forecast for 2021 so we can set the budget, and so we're working diligently to achieve the milestone. We will have a first public hearing in November, November 2nd, and our second public hearing regarding the budget on November 16th. And then, as mentioned, on December 7th, we'll come back to the board for their consideration and approval of the 2021 budget. Any comments or questions regarding the presentation today?
Have any other comments? Thank you very much, and a very thorough presentation. Appreciate your time and efforts on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We'll see you at the next board meeting.
Thanks, Mark. Bye.
Yeah. Bye.
Okay, Steve. Number six, wildfire update.
Okay, so we have a bit of a meaty presentation today, cover a variety of items. So there's a lot going on in the wildfire arena. Certainly a lot been going on in the western United States, and so we thought we would bring you up to date on a variety of things that we are working on. So the combination presentation, Rachel Hansen, Chad Bowman, Chad Reisman will be presenting, and then I'm going to do a wrap-up on an item that's related. Rachel, I'll turn it over to you. Rachel, you may be on mute.
Okay, does that work?
That's much better. There we go.
That's much better.
Oh, very good. Okay, excellent. Okay, well, let's start with slide two. So last spring, we planned a wildfire summit where we would invite all the partners, fire districts, nonprofits, state agencies. But with COVID, we had to cancel that event. But the work cannot wait. We're taking a new community-based approach, and we've reached out to some key agencies to learn more about the projects that are already underway that may have some mutual benefit. So before we get into that, slide three. A little refresher about efforts that are already underway. So as you know, we've increased the frequency of our inspections and our tree trimming cycle using a higher standard, and that is the International Wildland Urban Interface Code. We've disabled auto-reclosing in areas where there's high fire danger, like Lake Wenatchee and Plain. And in that case, power remains off until a crew can manually inspect the premises for potential fire starts. And this is already in action for transmission lines, and it's in development for distribution. And lastly, we're identifying areas where we can protect our lines with things like fire retardant paint, steel poles, or undergrounding. So slide four. So this is a visual representation of the new engagement strategy that we're pursuing. And I want to give credit to Rick Stratton, a fire scientist at the U.S. Forest Service for this model. But if you just imagine each slice of the Swiss cheese as a different stakeholder, and the holes are different wildfire mitigation projects they're working on, the PUD is looking for alignment where there's projects of mutual benefit. It's a more community-minded approach that could lead ultimately to the most value or the best value for the most people. And do we have any questions so far before I hand this over to Chad Bowman? Okay, hearing none. Chad, I'm going to pass this to you.
Thanks, Rachel. Slide five, then. One of the things that we've really benefited from, I think, in this more involved cooperative coordination strategy is really understanding the different studies that are out there and really how those studies affect our infrastructure, really looking for alignment in those studies. Of, for example, does our HDR study that we did in 2017, do the results of that align with some of the other studies that either have been done or are currently ongoing, all in a way to help us prioritize infrastructure and investments and understand really what investments in the infrastructure also have community benefits. And really coordinating our efforts with others, we really believe we can accomplish a lot more at both the neighborhood level and at the landscape level. Next slide. So this Pyrologic study is a Forest Service study that we knew was out there. We've recently become more acquainted with it. Annie Schmidt of Fire Adapted Community Networks was able to get a lot of this information for us and really help us understand what's going on in the study. So quite a bit of detail here, but it really starts in the upper left, where the Forest Service identified these highly valued resources and assets. Their wildfire model then predicts flame lengths from different types of fires. FIL-1 is a 1 foot flame length, through 6 is 6 feet flame length, and how those different assets are impacted by those different flame lengths. The Forest Service then ranked those different infrastructure components, came up with burn probability, and in the end resulted in some risk products for the Pacific Northwest. And this is Rick Stratton, Pyrologic Fire Forest Service study that was done in 2018. So if you go to the next slide where we zoom in on Chelan County, really looking at the risk assessment they've done, you probably are aware that one of the outputs of this study was really identifying Leavenworth as one of the, if not the highest at-risk community in the Northwest. Go to the next slide. One of the recent ongoing efforts, and this is, again, an example of where some of our community partners have really helped us become aware of what's going on and helped us engage in some of these efforts. Cascadia actually got us engaged in this DNR effort. It's really in response to House Bill 1784, where they're looking to do, the DNR is charged with doing forest health assessments in three pilot areas in Washington, the Metau, Clay Ellum, and the Leavenworth area. Part of their forest health assessment, and this is where it really brings quite a bit of value to us, is how to integrate that forest health assessment into wildfire response, which is PODs, these potential operational delineations, which are fuel breaks on the landscape, which are pre-programmed ahead of time. Folks are still working to determine how to best use these operational delineations. And what you see on the map there is really the colors that the wildfire model prioritized those fuel breaks. So our interest really is, where do those operational delineations align with our infrastructure, and is there an opportunity there to help mitigate risk and be part of that fire response where our infrastructure potentially aligns with those fuel breaks in terms of our veg management practices, perhaps under undergrounding, where are those high priority areas where we could align, what's going on at the broader perspective. Next slide. You all probably saw this a few years ago, the HDR risk assessment, where the items in red or orange are the higher priority areas at risk that we think are at risk. We drew in here as well kind of the solid lines where there's distribution infrastructure that we believe that's also at risk or that we would prioritize to mitigate risk. The results of the HDR study, again, that was performed in 2017, really aligned fairly well with some of those other studies that showed a few slides back.
And just a reminder that HDR is a consulting firm that we use that performed the risk assessment.
Thanks, Steve. So if you flip to the next slide. Dead Horse Canyon, there's a video that's embedded in this slide. I'm not going to play that video, but if you've got 20 minutes to spare, I'd really encourage you to take a look at that. That's a video from a helicopter inspection that we performed in 2018 that really highlights the heavily forested, tough to access, tall trees, not a lot of clearance through some areas where we think there's quite a bit of fire risk. And fire risk that would impact communities and customers, perhaps, you know, 3,400 customers. It would probably take us weeks or months to rebuild this infrastructure. So we're really looking at this outreach effort with the communities and partner agencies is to find out, you know, is there a common vision as we work on fire resiliency and where is our infrastructure investment best made? To protect not only our infrastructure, but also to provide that community protection benefit. This is one of the areas we're looking at. This is one of those places where we really think can apply some of those principles of, you know, best for the most for the longest, and really enjoyed working with some of our community partners, and we have a lot to learn and a lot to gain, and again, I think by working together on this effort, we can really achieve a lot more than we can working on our own. So with that, I'll pause before I turn it back to Rachel.
Okay, shall we move on to the next slide? This would be slide 11. Great. So as Chad was saying, we've been working with Annie Schmidt, and, you know, not only has she shared with us some data, but she's also sharing with us a few different things. She's sharing examples of utilities who are involved on a neighborhood level with fire mitigation, and some of those examples are Seattle Light, and there's a PUDI in the Tahoe area, so we're studying what they're doing as best practices and seeing how that applies to our own plan. And there's also an opportunity to get involved in the on the neighborhood level. There's over 25 different FireWise communities in the county. And there's each of these groups, they create neighborhood plans that's specific to their area. And that could include, you know, pruning and tree removal along critical emergency routes, creating or improving secondary escape routes, and, you know, installing reflective address signs, things like that. And I think there's an opportunity here for the PUD to get involved, sharing information about right tree, right place. And Annie has told us that there are several property owners that she's talked to who don't feel comfortable with vegetation management next to power lines. So there may be an opportunity for us to collaborate with property owners and share some of our knowledge. And FireWise is a great vehicle to do that. So next slide. Cascadia Conservation District, we're working with Patrick Haggerty. They have a long history of creating public and private partnerships. and they also secure grant funding for large-scale community projects. So we're drafting an interlocal agreement with Cascadia Conservation District to work with them and identify potential projects. And they've already found two opportunities so far that may be a candidate for a FEMA grant. They're in the pre-application state right now. Those projects are located in the Plain River Road area, and there's another one in the Greater Lake Wenatchee area. And both of these projects include fuel reduction, vegetation management, power line resiliency, and hazard tree removal. So we'll be working with them to see those applications through. Any questions before I turn this over to Chad Rissman?
This is Gary Arsenault. I'd like to just make more of a suggestion that the Upper Skulchuck Basin, which I know we have power lines that make their way all the way up to Mission Ridge, there's a FireWise community up there at Forest Ridge. And they're quite active and have worked with a variety of governmental agencies to receive both state and federal grants for thinning out vegetation surrounding that community and actually the upper basin. So that might be a community outreach that you'd want to make. The gentleman who's in charge of that FireWise operation is called Jerry Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S.
Thank you, Gary. I'll follow up with Jerry. That's really helpful. Okay, Chad, I'm going to pass this along to you. Chad Rissman.
Good morning, Commissioners. Next slide, please. Another tool we're considering in our toolbox of fire mitigation is the undergrounding distribution power lines. Converting overhead distribution power lines to underground. The costs and challenges associated with these conversions is really well documented. In many cases, not feasible just because of constructability, the number of connections, the size of the lines. However, in rural areas, these opportunities might be more feasible. And coincidentally, it is generally the rural areas that we're concerned with fire. So we're seeing this as a potential opportunity for us that might have a real business case and constructability. So in the rural areas, the lines are smaller, the number of connections are less sparse, the excavation is generally a little more straightforward. We might even have gravel or dirt or cross country instead of asphalt and improved areas that you would find in town. So all those things make the constructability of these conversions more possible. We currently have a facility modifications policy that's in place that allows customers to contribute to these conversions where we already have projects in place or where they want to make these conversions. But like I said before, and as part of our overall fire mitigation strategy, there might be positive business cases for us to look at these projects in specific areas where there's higher fire danger concern. We're putting into the budget request a few priority areas, one of those looking like the Plain River Road area and some others that we might consider through the budgeting process and looking at those business cases. So with our vegetation costs on the rise, we're doing more and more vegetation management. Of course, that supports a business case. For these conversions, we have forest health concerns and hazard trees that oftentimes are difficult to get after because, as Chad Bowman pointed out, some of these trees are really tall and can reach the line, so having a really wide swath might not might not be feasible. Of course, increased fire ignition concerns, right-of-way challenges. So we're discussing opportunities for us to define potentially some district-defined qualifiers. And maybe some of those qualifiers would look like constructability, cost-benefit, risk reduction, agency-defined fire risk areas, like what Chad Bowman was pointing out, the work that the Forest Service and DNR and some of our own studies are putting together. We can help us focus in where we would want to dig deeper into a business case, potentially support a conversion. Maybe I'll just pause there before I jump on to the next topic for any questions.
I just want to reinforce Chad's point here that we're approaching this cautiously, given that this was the subject of undergrounding distribution and transmission lines was a significant component of the strategic plan, and we concluded that we would not be doing that unless there was a contribution from customers. What's unique about this, and we think is probably would occur in a limited number of circumstances, is the question as to whether there's a business case because of fire risk associated with moving to undergrounding of distribution. So we don't view this as revisiting the issues in the strategic plan, more an evolution towards better understanding of fire risk, costs associated with vegetation management, and are there places where it would be in the best interest of all of our customers to underground particular circumstances?
Thank you, Steve. Next slide. Rachel had mentioned some opportunities that came up through some of these networking meetings and discussions that we've been having, and another one, thanks to Cascadia Conservation, turned us on to a potential opportunity where we've got a new substation that's in the design phase right now, Bavarian Substation, just along the lower end of Chumstick there, near Leavenworth, and lower Chumstick and North Road there, that intersection you can see in the outlined in the orange. Well, we have a number of new power lines and some power line modifications that are being planned and designed as a part of the substation in order to get power in and out of that substation to support growth and reliability in the Leavenworth area. Cascadia Conservation identified that there's a number of stakeholders that are interested in this property that's referred to as Rattlesnake Hill. There's several concerns by fire experts and the fire department, fire chiefs, and the community that this is a heavily forested area that's sort of in the middle of town, and some opportunities to mitigate that fire risk in this area have been under development. So there's a partnership with the DNR, the school district, MEND. There's a trail alliance to build some trails in here. Well, thanks to Cascadia Conservation, Patrick Hagedy, for identifying this, but we've started discussions with DNR, who's working on or has already identified some potential grants to support some of the efforts that are going on here. So we're entering into that discussion with those various agencies, recognizing that we're wanting to do some power line improvements. And we're wondering, like with some of these other collaborative efforts, if there's an area where the PUD's infrastructure improvements and changes might better coordinate with plans and activities that are already going on, and potentially find some overlap so that all of the resources that are being put into this area can be used with the highest efficiency. And maybe we can get more done, maybe even at a lower cost, or using the same amount of cost, there's more work within the fire mitigation effort that we can put to bear. So we're drilling through the details of that and trying to get a better understanding of how we can collaborate with the efforts that are going on there, but we just wanted to highlight this is another opportunity that's come out of our discussions and collaborations with these other agencies that Rachel identified. I'll pause there for a second before I turn it back over to Steve. Thank you, Commissioner. Steve?
Okay, so you've heard a little bit now. Again, this is a melding of a variety of different initiatives that we have going on with respect to wildfire risk. You've heard some about engaging with fire risk managers in the region, getting a better understanding of the where risk occurs in Chelan County, and particularly the high level of risk that there is in Chelan County relative to the rest of the state, how we're engaging with community-based organizations to try to partner with them on a variety of options to be able to reduce fire risk for customers, how we're beginning to think about distribution system undergrounding issues that in the past we would have thought did not have a business case and now potentially do as the risk world around us changes. Final area I'd like to speak about is the potential for using public safety power shutoffs. So up until 2 years ago, I'm unfamiliar with public safety power shutoffs being employed any place in the world. And with the wildfire events in California, they began to be employed there last year, pretty significantly employed, as a result of the liability that the utilities there incurred due to wildfire risk and some of the court actions that came about as a result of that liability. The California utilities implemented public safety power shutoffs in what I would call a blunt force manner through last year. It was their first big time through it. They shut off millions of people at a time. There was probably a not very good communication mechanism for discussing with their customers both before the fact and in the middle of the event what was going to be happening. So we looked at that and said, wow, that seems like a really difficult way to get to high levels of customer satisfaction, but we can also understand the liability risks that they were trying to deal with. Last year, the question came before us as to whether we would employ public safety power shutoffs, and we concluded that we would not, although we would go to the use of automatically reclosing, excuse me, not using automatic reclosers during periods of high fire risk. So in other words, if there's something goes out and we don't know what's going on, we want to deploy a crew to make sure that we understand it before we choose to reclose to try to limit the exposure for sparks and fire ignition. This year we've seen the use of public safety power shutoffs in a much more extensive way and a more refined way in California, at least. They put a lot of time into it and thought more a lot about how they would employ the PSPS and better communication, more limited use of it to try to focus on the places of higher risk. And then we saw the fires in Oregon. And there were a number of fires there. The one that particularly has caught our attention was the one in what's called the Sandingham Canyon, which is essentially east of Salem, goes up to Detroit Reservoir. There are three transmission systems in that arena, Pacific Core, Bonneville Power, and a local utility called Consumers Power. Consumers Power, interestingly enough, deployed PSPS prior to the significant fires that occurred. The other two, Pacific and Bonneville, as far as we know, did not. And you may have seen that they were pretty devastating fires that went through there, destroyed the town of Detroit, which sits on the reservoir, and did a significant amount of damage. And not surprisingly, there's a fair amount of litigation now popping up as a result of that. As a result of that, we definitely are reconsidering our thought about the use of PSPS. It's moving from something on the margins seems to candidly run against the philosophy that many of us have had about how do you maintain reliability. The idea of preemptively shutting people off is definitely a very new thought for us. On the other hand, I would say that what we're seeing is a sense that the use of PSPS is starting to be perceived as a best practice in the mind of the public, and may well become so with respect to the court system. So we are beginning to rethink our position with respect to the use of PSPS. It's a difficult thing to do, as we've come to understand. It's not just a matter of an on-off switch. Will you use it or not? There's a set of protocols that you want to think about to make sure that you have communicated to customers the potential use of it. Protocols even in terms of when it might be used and what the communication mechanisms will be around that. The types of conditions that we would consider it for are ones in which there was high fire risk and high winds. It's the combination of the two that really creates the biggest exposure. That's what tends to cause lines to touch each other, to potentially create outages and sparks. I think I would speak for myself here. The basic feeling I've got at this point is that saying that we would never use PSPS is probably not the right place to be as we move towards the next fire season next year. That it should be a tool in our toolbox for operators that under extreme circumstances that we may choose to deploy. I don't know that Consumers Power necessarily would have known in advance that they were facing the kind of exposure that they did, but their choice to deploy it in that situation appears to have been a wise one. So we want to at least give ourselves a chance to, if necessary, be able to have that tool available for both our operators and, I would say, from a management perspective as well. So more to come on this. I just wanted to put it on the screen that we are rethinking our policies here, and we'll be back to the board at some future date. With that, we are open to questions, and I might also let the board know that there was a possibility that we might have a couple of members of the public who would like to comment as well.
Okay. Am I coming through, Steve?
Yes, we can hear you.
This is a big issue, and I'm not sure how to frame my question. For the last 25 years, I know that the land-grant university system in the western state has listed urban-rural interface and wildfire risk at the top of their priority list. There's a lot of research that has gone on as it relates to best management practices. How do you deal with the urban-rural interface and the risk of wildfire? And I think, you know, us taking this seriously because of where we're located is the right thing to do. What I'm wondering out loud after viewing this presentation is if we're attempting to do everything we do maybe too much with blinders on, and that's the wrong term there, but not looking broadly enough for not only potential best management practices, but collaborative approach to policy recommendations that could be made, knowing that so much of the land that we're dealing with is public land. I just thought that out as a thought.
Well, I think you see us in the midst of a transition. The discussion that you heard earlier with respect to the meetings with the Forest Service, DNR, fire managers, particularly in the Upper Valley, is about trying to think about this in a very different way. You know, in the past, what we would do is say, we have a problem and we have a solution. And I think what we're trying to do is now say, when we talk about we is much bigger than the PUD. The we is the community has a problem. And that community includes land managers that are at the state and federal level. And since they are they've spent a lot more time on fire risk than we have, including working with the academic community that I think you're referring to. We're looking to them to help us to understand the body of work that's out there to better understand the fire risk associated with wildland-urban interfaces. So we're on a path to do exactly what you're talking about, I think. We're trying to broaden our horizons and look to those who have expertise to be able to help us and, candidly, to help them to try to figure out the best path forward. I think your comment also suggested the potential for public policy recommendations. I think that is possible, that this will come out of the discussion, that we'll better understand where risk is and then be able to react to that, including recommendations that could occur at the state or federal level.
Good. I appreciate that feedback. Good.
Steve, this is Dennis. Just thinking about, you know, the model of a T-chart, you know, what would be the benefits and what would be the, you know, what's the upside and what's the downside, you know, and kind of list those in bullet point for those of us who aren't as well-versed, you know, in these issues, to kind of take a look at that would be helpful for me.
Okay, let me make sure I understand. So you'd like sort of pros and cons. Are you thinking generally about managing wildfire risk, or are you thinking specifically about public safety power shutoffs?
Yeah, public power shutoffs.
Right. Yeah, I can do that.
What are the upsides? What are the downsides? To that decision.
Yeah, I can do that quickly now, and we'll do something more thorough later. But the simple trade-off is that you would have a set of customers that have longer outages than they would have otherwise had. You'd be choosing to say, we need to shut off this area in order to reduce the risk of fire ignition coming from either our transmission or distribution system. The benefit comes to the extent that you have reduced sparks and therefore fire ignition. And it'd be a hard one to actually quantify, because you wouldn't know what would have happened in the alternative scenario where you hadn't deployed PSPS, other than you can look to other communities and the risks that they incurred. And what we are seeing is this incredible liability exposure for example, the California utilities have experienced all the way up to forcing bankruptcy for Pacific Gas and Electric. We also see it in the form of insurance. We know that, and we've reported to our board that we are seeing premium increases, and we're seeing less players in the market willing to provide wildfire risk insurance to electric utilities in the West. And so We have felt that it was extremely important for us to be proactive in this regard, as we were, even with the actions that we took last year, to try to put ourselves in a good position to be able to get decent insurance at a reasonable rate. That exposure, given that what has happened in California this summer and now in Oregon this summer, so it's moving north, we expect to have even more challenges in the insurance market in the coming years.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner McKenna, yes, please.
You know, this is it's always a very sobering discussion. I want to thank Chad Rissman and Rachel for giving us such a great presentation. I think that this work really reinforces our mission and our vision as an organization. I appreciate the ability and interest and dedication of our staff to you know, evaluate our position and our policy and study it and learn and keep the board apprised. And I think it's the right direction. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I don't know if we have any anybody else that wants to add comment from the public on this.
Dennis, again, I just want to say, you know, worthy, you know, consideration, particularly when you have the knowledge you know, that was presented, you know, to us today, that Leavenworth is the most at-risk community in the state. You know, and that's a community that we serve deeply in the middle of our county. You know, it's really a worthy topic. It has pretty broad implications. So, you know, thanks for the topic and for the presentations and. And I think for the thoughtfulness that's been put into it, looking forward to more information and further discussion. There's a lot here.
So, final comment for me and for any that were around for the 1994 rat brick fires, and could watch the mountainsides beside Leavenworth exploding in flame at night. It's a scary prospect. And that fire was really, really close to Leavenworth at that moment. And it was just for winds shifting and dying down that Leavenworth was spared 25 years ago.
So I'll just go ahead and open this up. Go ahead, Gary.
Thank you, Steve. I just wanted to throw in a few comments, and one of which is I know the county, Chelan County, is and the county commissioners are very concerned about wildfire, have appropriated some money to mitigate some of the areas that are dry kindling, and also working on plans to expand their efforts throughout the county and modify some of the rules that might permit additional logging to occur, which would also be an economic driver. So that might be a partner that we would want to reach out to in terms of coordinating efforts and making sure that each penny is well spent and used in the most efficient manner, not only to protect the infrastructure, but also to maximize the benefits received from all of the both state and federal dollars.
Commissioner Arsenault, just to give you comfort, we are actively engaged with the county. In fact, we co-sponsored a meeting with the State Department of Natural Resources last year and the county. Bob Ugert and Mike Caputa took a lead for the county in terms of the discussions, and Chad Bowman in particular has been active in conversations with them, and we intend to continue to be very actively engaged with them.
Thank you, Steve.
Very good. So at this time, I just want to open it up, make sure that we don't have anybody else wishing to comment on this subject. With no one adding any questions, again,
this is
there someone there that would like. Go ahead, Patrick.
Good morning. This is Patrick Haggerty with Cascadia Conservation District. I just wanted to jump in and let the commissioners know that I appreciated listening in on this conversation this morning, and I've appreciated working with Chad Rissman and Chad Bowman for the last couple of months, and Rachel and several of your other staff as they've really engaged in some of the ongoing work that's going on with the Forest Service and the DNR and Chelan County, and local fire chiefs and their real interest in engaging in partnerships and using the resources that the PUD has wisely to really kind of leverage the work that they're doing and kind of expand that across boundaries and around their infrastructure. And so we certainly look forward to trying to continue to work with the PUD moving forward to identify opportunities. I think a lot of the conversations that I know I've had and I've had with Chad and local fire chiefs and Forest Service fire responders have covered quite a few of the comments that I heard from the commissioners this morning. So I think that we're going to have a lot of overlap moving forward with ongoing efforts. And it's great to see the PUD taking this issue really seriously.
Great. I appreciate those thoughts. Thank you for joining us today. Do we have any other comments? Okay, Steve, I'm going to turn this back over to you.
Okay, we're
at 11:36.
Yeah, we're a little bit ahead of schedule. We do have some manager items, and we think that we could knock those out this morning, make things go a bit more efficiently this afternoon. I want to invite John Stoll up. He has two items for us today.
Good morning, commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Yeah, thanks. First one I'd like to talk about, I talk about pole fires. You may have seen through the outage reports last weekend, we had several pole fires in our county. Wanted to do a little digging into that, so worked with engineering to get some reports on it. In the past, it seems like about every 3 or 4 years, we get the right precipitation right after a dry summer, and it tends to create these, you know, what we call pole fires. So I wanted to look into that, see if there were any trends or patterns, anything that would be of interest. So I just wanted to share that with you folks today. There were about six of them. They were over the weekend, basically from, I think, Saturday the 10th through Monday the 12th. It seemed like we went from late summer to late fall in the span of a week. With that, we had some precip events and rain. And when that happens after a dry, hot summer, there could be particles, dirt, dust that have just accumulated on generally our porcelain equipment. Think of the cutouts or certain insulators. And if they happen to go through a freeze-thaw cycle over years, they tend to get cracks, which hold some of that dirt and debris. You introduce water, and if the rain isn't strong enough to actually wash off these insulators, it can actually generate a path for the current to flow. Typically what happens is it flows over this current through these, say, a cutout or an insulator, and it hits the cross arm, wood cross arm, and then it'll create an arc or a slow burn. It may ignite or it may just be an arc, but generally that creates a system outage, and of course then we go out and we fix it. So again, I wanted to just dig into that, see if there was anything there that would tell us some more information. Generally, again, this happens with older equipment. You may recall from our reliability presentation a few months ago, that's one of our strategies, is to continue to replace out that older equipment. We've also changed our standards over the years. About 5 years ago, we went to fiberglass cross arms, which, because of their insulating properties, you know, that's just another layer of insulation to avoid having these situations. And of course, we've also gone away from any of the porcelain type equipment, and we've gone to more of a rubber polymer type insulator or cutout. Wanted to see if there are any trends around or any certain areas, and you know, basically they were fairly widespread throughout the county, from Chelan, Peshaston, I think there was one at the Chumstick, Malaga, and one or two in Wenatchee. Yeah, that's what I wanted to report, just see if you have any questions. But when we have an event like this, it's always worth taking the time and doing a little look into it to see if there's anything that tell us to do something different. But we are, of course, to continue to watch those. There's no real silver bullet or way to fix it overnight. But again, just programmatically going through our system and looking at these issues. Stop there if there's any questions.
Commissioners, I would just add that one of the advantages of having a goal towards being a top quartile utility means that when these types of events come up, they give you new information about risk to achieving your goal, and then you can put that into your analysis in terms of taking cost-effective action. So would it be more cost-effective to accelerate a program that addresses pole fires versus other things? You know, that all becomes a part of a process that you go through in terms of developing budgets on an annual basis. So wouldn't expect any changes because this is new information for the 2021 budget, but you know, get the opportunity is there to be able to revisit as we travel through time here and better understand whether it makes sense to make investments that would support higher levels of reliability to address this particular concern.
So, John, this is Randy, and I for one really appreciate that update because when situations like that occur, we commissioners invariably get questions about what's happening, and to have our memories refreshed as to how our system works or sometimes has fault, it's really valuable just to have the information. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, Commissioner. Anytime. The next item I'd like to just go over with you concerns some proposed phone changes. Late last week, I sent out an email just kind of giving you a preview of this. But essentially, what we're planning to do, if you approve, is to, effective November 2nd, which is a Monday, we want to temporarily adjust the phone hours that go into the customer relations group. That's the group you heard from this morning with Carrie and her team. And really free up some time in the morning so that group can be focused on several key efforts. The phones would then be turned on at noon and then, of course, run through normal business hours. The things that we really want to focus on pertain to training a number of new staff. We've had some turnover. We've got some really good candidates joining our team. But with our system and everything we have, it's really helpful if we can give them some focused training. And certainly with COVID, that adds a little bit more of a challenge. In addition, we have a bit of a time constraint with our lead trainer who will be out on leave for a bit. So that's one of the big reasons for proposing this, as well as we also have some work to do with the rate implementation efforts for December 1st. We are still working through some things on our new billing system, the C2M system. You know, it's going well, it's working well, but there's still a lot of work to do to continue to make that system operate as effectively as it can. And then it would also allow us some more focused, maybe outbound calling. Again, we've struggled a little bit. I think you heard that in the last COVID report that the team didn't always have enough time to do some of those proactive calls and outreach. This will provide an opportunity as well to do that. On the other side, when we do have the phone lines open, there's an opportunity to have more folks on the phone, in the phone queue, basically, to answer phones in a more timely manner. We won't have to balance and shift lunch breaks around, so should actually improve some call response times there. Now, we will work through the phone system and be sure to have an opportunity for folks to take advantage of our automatic approaches, whether they want to pay over the phone using that payment approach, leave a message, and there is a way to actually get through, and if somebody has something we really need to talk to folks, we'll have that option as well. I'll stop there, see if there's any questions. And I believe Carrie's on the line, too, so if there's something I didn't cover, if there's a question for her as well. And again, our goal is to be able to just do it for the months of November and December and then beginning of the year with staff trained up and hopefully a more normalized operation, we go back to the 8 to 5 phone hours.
John, thank you for the update on those two items. Commissioner, any further questions?
Commissioners, we have two other items under manager items, and Ron Slabaugh is going to cover both of them. Ron, are you on?
Yes, Steve, I'm here. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, we can.
Excellent. Well, Ron Slabaugh, water and wastewater manager. Good late morning, commissioners. Two items we have to discuss today are an update on the regional water meeting that Commissioner Arsenault and I attended, and also the Dryden wastewater project. We'll start with regional water. We attended the regional coordinating committee meeting on September 30th. Nothing out of the ordinary. I think it lasted right at an hour. We discussed the three main items that I presented to this board back in September, and that is the regional second source update and the water rights, the Crown Columbia water rights lease and the lineage water rights. Not a whole lot has changed. We still have not, regional still has not drilled that well out on the Malaga property to determine whether or not there is any water there. That is still anticipated to occur this year. Well, with respect to the Crown water rights, we're still working through the amendment to the agreement that would be required. There, we received an update from Pete Fraley, who represents regional, particularly with water rights issues, and he's working through some new issues that Department of Ecology has brought up with the way that Crown is providing this water to Granite Farms down in the Port of Walla Walla. The issue has nothing to do with regional, but Pete just wants to make sure that all the regional's rights are fully protected. So he's spending a little bit more time digging into that, and he will eventually have that amendment to that agreement back in front of us for review. With lineage, the Pete has put together the draft agreement for purchase of that water right. And I believe he was getting it in front of the city's attorney. They have Mark Peterson representing them in this issue, and we'll eventually have something to bring back to this board for approval. And then the other item that we discussed that, at the regional meeting was the overall regional budget. We usually meet this time of year and go over the budget. Regional's budget is not a whole lot to it. It takes up just about a page and a half. Real briefly, looking at 2020 versus 2021, operations and maintenance in 2020 was just over $1 million, about $1.3 million, proposed to go up about 2.3% to $1,025,000 in 2021. And it's the typical increases that we see from labor, benefits, supplies, contracts, that sort of thing. There's a proposed $69,000 increase for second source planning from $100,000 in 2020 to $169,000 in 2021. And that's about it. The overall increase is about $93,000, I believe. We are also proposed another 10% increase to the regional wholesale cost. I believe this would be the fourth one in a row. And that's just trying to save up for the regional second source that we know we're going to have to pay for someday and reduce the amount that regional will need to bond for that improvement. So that was proposed. For the year 2020, the good news is regional is building cash. For 2020, the regional fund balance is forecasted to be $4.6 million. And for 2021, forecasted to go up to $5.8 million, and that's even with the spending that's in forecasted in this budget. So before we move on to Dryden, are there any questions about regional or comments? Okay. Does anybody have any concerns with the regional budget that you would like us to get back to the city on? Okay. I haven't heard anything. Should we move on to Dryden?
Please do, Ron.
Yes, let's go ahead.
Oh. Okay. Thank you. So Dryden Wastewater, we're following a similar path to Peshastin as far as fulfilling the ecology requirements and such. We had a compliance, so we received a new permit for Dryden back in June of 2019, and it included a requirement that we submit an engineering report update to ecology by October 1st of 2020, which we did. We met that. That established our planning level cost estimate for Dryden, which fortunately is consistent with the forecast we put in place a year or two ago, but it's expensive. The exact number was $3.478 million. One of the complications we have with Dryden, of course, is we only serve about 50 connections. You run the math on that, it's about $70,000 per connection. So it's really expensive. So to help alleviate some of that, we did apply for ecology funding, again, just like we did twice for Peshastin. That application was due October 13th, I believe, and we met that deadline. And ecology offers combination grant and loan for these projects, and of course we applied for both. We don't know exactly what we will be eligible for. We did, about a year ago, receive the preliminary funding eligibility from ecology, and it's not a guarantee. They just take a look at our project, what we know about our project at that time, and the conditions that were in place for past funding years. And they figured that we could be eligible for somewhere in the 66 to 70% grant funding. We are going to continue to work with them and just see if it's at all possible to get that up higher, like up towards that 100% range. I certainly can't guarantee anything, but the price of this project for such a small community is honestly out of control. For what it's worth, I've talked with several different engineers. You know, given our effluent limitations, what we have to do to meet the requirements of that Wenatchee River TMDL, that is to reduce phosphorus, and thus far have not been able to come up with anything that's less costly than what we're proposing here. So overall, just again, want to give you an update on that submittal, those two submittals to ecology, let you know where we are with respect to costs and what we're planning going forward on trying to maximize the amount of external funding that we can find for this project. Any questions, comments on Dryden?
Commissioners, I just want to note this is a substantially higher cost than we've talked about in the past, and so we are working with Ron, Tracy Yount, and others to think through a strategy for approaching ecology about this. As he said, that this cost is exorbitant, and we're going to need to try to find a way to be able to manage the cost down or get a larger amount of grant money. Okay, not hearing any questions, that actually wraps up our manager items, and I would suggest now would probably a good time to break for lunch, and then we could come back and pick up the business session as was originally planned for this afternoon.
That sounds fine. Do you have any comments to the commissioners? Unless we stand for the new permit, and we'll be back at 1 p.m.
And call-in number, Steve?
Be the same call-in number, yes.
Yes.
And by the way, Commissioners, just so you know that we do not have an executive session item for this afternoon, so we will be finished when we finish the business session.
Okay, thanks.
Very good. Okay.
Thank you, everybody. I'll talk to you at 1.
Good afternoon. We are resuming our afternoon session with the Chelan County
Board of Commissioners, October, what is the date today? I forgot. The 19th?
Yes.
2020. Because of COVID, we are meeting virtually, and we would ask people to mute their phones until they are ready to address the commission. So, Steve, I think not hearing Gary on the line, we should probably go ahead and do our consent agenda and then move into our regular agenda items.
Yes, sir.
Gary's here now.
There's Gary.
I would move approval of
And that includes item number 9?
Correct.
A resolution? Okay. All those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Motion carries. Oh, I didn't ask if there was any discussion. Motion carries. Steve, go ahead with item number 10 with Mr. Miller.
Okay, great. So the PUD has been engaged with Northwest River Partners for many years. So Kurt Miller has come to River Partners. He'll help me on this. I think it was a couple of years ago. And he's done some terrific work. He's developed a 5-year plan. This is our advocacy group for supporting hydropower in the Pacific Northwest. And so we feel very aligned with them, work with them very closely. Thought it was important for the board to see their overview of where they're trying to go with their 5-year plan. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Kurt Miller, the executive director.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the invitation, Steve, to meet with the board today. And yeah, it's been just basically a year and a half now, so time flies. When I came in, I was really excited about, you know, kind of a vision of, you know, where we'd eventually go with River Partners. And with this last year of work, a year and a half of work, I was able to work with our board and our members to devise a 5-year board-approved plan, which we're really excited about. And which we think helps take us as an organization to the next level. Before I dive in too deeply, I wanted to say a couple things. One, I truly appreciate the partnership of Steve and his team. He's been a mentor to me as I've gotten up to speed. You know, there's a lot of different issues that we face, in this realm, and it's hard to be expert on all of them. And so I really relied heavily on Steve and his experience, and he's been really just a pleasure to deal with, as is his team. They've been really supportive. So thank you to all the Chelan and PUD folks. And also thank you to the board for its support, not only of River Partners, but of our digital media campaign called Our Power is Water, where I'll talk a little bit more about that later in this presentation. But we really appreciate the way that Chelan and PUD stepped forward to provide a lot of support. So anyway, I did want to start with that. Also, I'm not a super formal person, so please feel free if you have questions to interject, and if not, I'll try to leave time at the end. So with that, we'll move forward. So could you advance the slide, Rebecca? Oh, thank you. So today we'll talk a little bit about the following areas related to the 5-year plan, kind of our partnerships, our history, the changing world in which we find ourselves, and then ultimately what our 5-year plan hopes to achieve to adapt to that changing world. Next slide. So first of all, that's a picture of me on my last vacation. No one can prove it's not because the guy has the helmet on. Northwest River Partners started in 2005 as the Coalition for Smart Salmon Recovery. And as many of you know, Steve actually was a driving force behind the foundation of that organization. When he was at Bonneville Power, he recognized the BPA really isn't in a position to be an advocate. They have to be a neutral agency. And so he came to Public Power and just said, you know, listen, we're constantly being attacked by a lot of claims that, you know, probably aren't super true. And, you know, you guys are going to need to have your own way to engage in these topics and correct the record and make sure the word gets out about hydropower and its benefits to the region. And so as a result of that leadership, Northwest River Partners, or the Coalition for Smart Salmon Recovery, was formed. And the mission was to be a strong voice in defense of the Federal Columbia River power system. Today we have, I think, right either 99 or 100 members, and including, I think we've added 5 member utilities this year, people who had been members in the past but had fallen off but have now rejoined. So we're really, we really appreciate that, that good faith support. Next slide. So, we mentioned kind of what our founding goal was, but we also recognize that the world is changing. And you can look at this chart and you could see that going back to 2007 and then 2009, almost 9/10 of the region considered hydropower to be a renewable resource. As time has moved forward, you could see that that number has dipped down to 60% or below. Most recent figure came from last summer at 60%. So that's a really big decline in the way that the Pacific Northwest region, the citizens here, look at hydroelectricity, and obviously it's not a step in the right direction. Next, please. This next chart here actually even shows that it's much more serious among kind of upcoming age groups. So you could see that in this chart, when we ask people what the most important source of electricity is in the region, that the baby boomers, almost half of them identify hydropower as the most important source. That drops down for kind of the Generation X group at 33%, and then the kind of Millennials Gen Z group is down to 24%. That is slightly less, that 24%, than the 25% of Millennials and Gen Z who see solar power as the region's most important resource. And you have to think about that in terms of context. Solar power in this region provides roughly, it's less than 1% of the region's total electricity. Hydropower represents close to 50% of the region's total electricity, yet we have this younger age group who actually thinks solar power is more important. And it's not necessarily that they're misinformed, but in terms of, you know, important could mean a lot of different things. We didn't ask them what the biggest resource was. But it does get to their opinion of kind of what they want to see. And you can see that we really have a lot of work to do with that younger age group. Next slide. So thinking about how to engage this younger age group and this younger demographic, we revised our mission with board approval in 2019. And we really wanted to more closely align with the values that we believe that demographic really represents. And so our new mission statement is to lead the charge for the Northwest to realize its clean energy potential using hydroelectricity as the cornerstone. And you could see there that and one of the big messages we have, and I can't remember if this is later in the slide, but one of the big messages we have is that hydropower is not only important in its ability to provide renewable energy, but it's also critical in its ability to help other renewables provide energy, because it can flex to those other renewables needs. So if you love wind power or if you love solar power, then you're going to love hydropower, because hydropower makes it all go. And so you could see that we're really trying to hitch our wagon to the fact that these younger generations really do, they're really concerned about climate change, and they are really supportive of these other forms of renewable resources. And so we want them to understand how important hydropower is to that ultimate desire they have to reduce carbon emissions in the region. Next slide. So goals for Northwest River Partners. Not only did we revise our mission, but we also revised our goals. So one is to fight climate change through clean energy and transportation. Another is to restore healthy fish populations to Northwest rivers, include vulnerable communities in the region's clean energy future, and maintain an affordable, dependable electric grid. And we think those are values that really the whole region can get behind. You know, they might not all be perfectly for you, but that generally speaking, we think that it's going to hit with most people, and we really believe that this will speak to kind of this emerging ethic around climate change and the social equity that the younger generation truly cares about, and we are showing them how we are aligned with them, and we really are. The things that we work for are really in alignment with what is important to them, and I think the big challenge is that they just haven't seen that before, and so we're really trying to let them know that a vote for hydropower is a vote for things that they value. Next slide. So also, one of the things we've done, as I mentioned before, to counteract the negative trend amongst the younger demographic is we launched the 2020 Our Power is Water digital media campaign. And this is a really significant campaign that was aimed at and is aimed at a certain demographic within the Pacific Northwest. And it's we worked with the North Advertising Agency, and they basically identified a group which they nicknamed the Curious Caretaker, which were people from 18 to 42 years old, so millennials and Gen Z, who care about the environment, but who also care about community. So they're not environment above people, they're like environment and people. And we think that those values align really closely with what public power, what utilities like Chelan PUD bring. You know, they bring not only clean, renewable energy, but you're also very concerned about your communities, about people who are less fortunate, and making sure that they have access to electricity. So we're showing them kind of the alignment with those values. Our goal for the end of the year is to achieve this as 25 million, it's actually 26 million completed video views, amongst that demographic around the Pacific Northwest. So far we have 19 million completed video views, and we're on course to achieve the 26 million by the end of the year or closely thereafter. But anyway, so far so good. Again, we've definitely reached a lot of people. 19 million completed video views are verified amongst our target demographic. And not only that, but the initial numbers we've seen in terms of people's opinions about hydropower have been positively changed. The preliminary number we saw at the start of August, about 50% of the people in this age group supported hydroelectricity, and by mid-September, that number had jumped to 59%. So we're going to see some other numbers come in, I hope, this week, where we'll be able to provide additional information about how effective the campaign has been. But so far, the initial number that we have seen was positive, so we're excited about that. Also, for people who aren't necessarily just watching digital or social media, we've also been successful in placing 1 to 2 opinion pieces in regional media outlets each month. We're actually on course to do perhaps 24 op-eds published this year, which is for our part, we feel it's a major accomplishment. One nice thing about hydropower is it just ties into so many different topics, whether it's, affordability and equity or climate change or blackouts and avoiding blackouts and things like that. There's a slew of different ways that we've been able to talk about hydropower to the demographic that actually reads newspapers or looks at online, media pieces. So that's been good too. And then we continue to grow our social media presence. Next slide. So funding, where do we stand? So one thing, and I've been showing this around this year because I think it's really important for people to understand, is I think that the thing that I didn't realize when I came into Northwest River Partners is the exact nature or the magnitude of the challenge that we face in supporting and defending hydroelectricity. And so I use this slide just to give you a sense of the nature, the magnitude of the organizations that have spoken out against hydroelectricity in the last year. So there, in the recent Columbia River System Operations Environmental Impact Statement process, there was an opportunity for groups such as River Partners and others to provide feedback to the federal action agencies. And I have listed here groups that, and not all of them, there's a mix of groups here, but groups that spoke in favor of breaching the four lower Snake River dams, they had annual revenues in this last year of around 500, I'm sorry, the last recorded year that was made public, it was 2018, of $500 million combined annual revenues. Our annual revenues for the same year were $880,000. So you could see that, you know, and the one thing I've been really clear about is that these organizations, they're not spending all of their money in the Northwest or specifically on the lower Snake River dams or hydropower, but they have such tremendous, with those kind of revenues, you can imagine that they just have such tremendous access to legislators, to the media, to kind of everybody. And so it really is an uphill battle that we're fighting. And it's one of the reasons that we have notified members that we are planning on increasing dues significantly this coming year for 2021 and then possibly again for 2022. It's just we need to be on more equal footing. We don't expect to get to hundreds of millions of dollars at all, but we want to get to over $1 million and be able to do some things more sustainably. Next slide, please. So that brings us to our five-year objective. And our five-year objective is for Northwest River Partners to drive the regional and national narrative about Northwest hydropower. So right now, I think that, you know, we've been doing a decent job. I think I'm proud of what we've been able to accomplish in this last year and a half. And I think we're doing a better job of trying to drive that regional conversation. We also want to drive the national narrative because occasionally we do see these national, you know, New York Times or CNN or E&E News or different groups like that take on hydropower. And so we want to be the group that helps to drive that conversation. And so the goals in our five-year plan are with this objective in mind. Next slide, please. So how do we get there? So first of all, public engagement, which we'll talk about, government affairs, members and partners, and new support. So next slide. So first of all, around public engagement, we're going to continue, our plan is to continue to do paid media campaigns. We'll continue to be looking for member support on that. We'll also continue to work hard on op-eds and then also continue to grow our social media. For the paid media campaigns, one thing we're definitely going to do is look, once all the numbers come in, at the effectiveness of this year's campaign and then adjust accordingly. And we will share those numbers with our members so they can see, you know, exactly how their dollars had impact and how we may want to adjust for upcoming campaigns. In addition, in terms of public engagement over the next 5 years, we want to actually sponsor or host some community events. We also want to do a lot more on the grassroots side. We see that our opponents or the competition, I don't mean this badly. I know that, you know, they're doing what's right in their hearts. But we see how active they are at community engagement and activities and fundraising. And so those are things that we want to look at ourselves. The other thing we want to do, and I know Steve put me in touch with some of his staff members who have kicked off a really good K-12 educational effort. And that's something that we'd like to see mirrored across the entire Northwest. So we think that we need to get in early with kids and let them see for themselves what the benefits of hydroelectricity are. And then also we'll be looking for more national media opportunities. Again, these are all thing objectives over the next 5 years. Next slide. Government affairs. Currently, we have really good participation in public processes. So whether it was the Columbia River System Operations Environmental Impact Statement, or the recent EPA report, which is the total maximum daily load for temperatures in the Columbia River Basin. We have provided, I think, substantive comments and information to the federal agencies to help give them enough scientific standing that they can support the initiatives that we're proposing. We've also shown, I think we've done a good job of engaging BPA especially, and to a certain extent, the Army Corps of Engineers and NOAA Fisheries, so other federal agencies, and we'll continue to work on those relationships. The other thing we want to really do, and this is something that we plan on doing for 2021, is hiring a full-time employee to help us advocate for federal policies and state and regional policies. So that's something where, just candidly, I just have not had the time to focus my attention because of all the other things that we're working on. And so we believe hiring a full-time person will enable us to much more effectively maintain contact with the Northwest delegation and with our members, and kind of work together to speak with one voice on hydroelectric related policy issues. Next slide. Members and partners. So we can, you know, I mentioned before that I think we've added 5 new members this year. We're really excited about that. I think it shows a tremendous, you know, faith in people to kind of revisit and come back, and we're really excited about that. We also want to collaborate, and we've been doing that really well with our current members. Chelan PUD is on our biology committee that we meet with once a month to talk about new and emerging fish and wildlife issues. We also engage our members around public policy and communications. And then we do our very best as well to support membership needs. So there will oftentimes be issues that where maybe hydroelectricity is being attacked in the local media or by an advocacy group, and our members will ask us for information to help them bolster their case for hydropower, and we're very happy to provide that assistance whenever possible. Also, and I mentioned earlier, we're planning on increasing dues in support of this plan for both the first and probably second year. And then next slide. But the other thing we definitely want to do, we understand that the ability to increase dues is not unlimited, that our members have constrained budgets, and we recognize the importance of that. So one of our big goals is to also increase our new membership. And one of the places we really feel like we have an opportunity to do that is in the kind of the new industrial customers that are coming into the region. And you all are super familiar with the data centers and the high-tech firms that are using a lot, and they're coming here specifically for the clean, renewable, affordable hydroelectricity that the system, both federal and public system, provide. And so we feel like it's incredibly important for us to make contact with them and to get their support. So that the burden of hydroelectric advocacy can be shared kind of across more shoulders, and at the end of the day, we believe that is kind of the key to us being able to grow and achieve these goals. The other thing we want to do is explore the possibility of creating a 501c3 organization. Northwest River Partners is a 501c6 organization, which means that we cannot receive individual contributions. By creating a 501c3 organization, kind of partnered with that, we should be able to do individual fundraising and other things like that, which we think could potentially help. Next slide. So this is at the end of the day, you know, we really did have a very thoughtful conversation with our board of directors about kind of this, you know, this expanded view for Northwest River Partners. And, this quote actually is, pretty much aligns with a quote that came from Kevin Nort, who is our board chair at Northwest River Partners. And it says, there are risks and costs to action, but they are far less than the long-range risk of comfortable inaction. And I think that we all recognize, you know, the board and myself, that if we really do want to gain the upper hand in these in this advocacy effort, that we are going to have to grow and do more, because we are just up against such a formidable machine. And again, I say that with all respect to the people who are kind of on the other sides of this issue. They are incredibly good at what they do. They're very professional, and they're really well funded. And so, you know, with that, it's because I have that respect for them that I know that we need to also kind of step up our efforts. Next slide. So really, that's it. That's kind of the quick version of kind of where we want to be in 5 years and the steps that we see ourselves taking. And I would be happy to answer any questions if there's time.
Kurt, this is Steve McKenna.
Hi, Steve.
As the board chair today. I want to thank you for the delightful presentation. I felt like I was on a Warren Miller ski film, you know, it kind of got me excited about winter and skiing. And, man, you had the dog in there. And you
I know, it's all there. You know, my name is Kurt Miller, so when I first started, I showed a similar presentation to people, and I told them that Warren Miller was my grandfather, which is totally not true, but it's unverifiable. So,
Yeah, absolutely. I love the feel. Well, thanks for coming before us and sharing more information about Northwest River Partners and the update on the efforts of the organization on behalf of hydropower. And I really appreciate that. So, board members, any other comments or questions for Kurt?
Steve, this is Gary.
Go ahead, Gary.
I have a question for Kurt. Kurt, can you kind of give us a quick profile? You mentioned how much money the other side has at their disposal. Can you kind of give us a quick profile as to where the what's the source of that money?
That's a great question. I know that for a lot of them, I mean, some of these organizations, of course, they do tremendous individual fundraising. So, you know, if you think of like the National Resources Defense Council or Earth Justice or Trout Unlimited, they have huge membership, you know, kind of smaller, huge membership. So the annual dues that they collect from the public are huge. But also, they do also have, in some cases, very significant, corporate sponsorship. If you think of Patagonia as an example, that's done, you know, that I believe has contributed millions and millions of dollars to kind of the anti-hydro campaign. Also, the Paul Allen Foundation. I forget the name of the actual organization, but the late Paul Allen has an organization that is also funded some of these organizations extensively and supported studies. So they have a really good mix right now. I mean, they have a really good mix of both kind of individual and then kind of large private donors. And I think that's, you know, and then they also have a lot of assets. So they're able to invest, I think, a significant part of that. And that's resulted in growth as well. So it's a combination of different things. I'm not an expert on that topic, but those are a few of the things that I'm aware of, Gary.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Well, great. You guys, hey, listen, I really do appreciate the opportunity to get to talk to you, and thank you for taking the time, and, you know, just thank you to the entire utility for its support and partnership. It's been so helpful, and we really value your guys and your opinion, and we look forward to that partnership going forward. And if there are any questions that do come up after this, please, Steve knows how to get a hold of me, and so just please feel free to shoot anything my way, and be happy to help.
Great. Kurt, thank you again for being with us today.
Okay, great. Hey, you guys stay safe. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we are looking at our proposed board meeting schedule for 2021. Let's see, I jumped the agenda here, and let me go back and look at this.
That's correct, Commissioner. We're up to commission items.
Okay. All right, so we're looking to approve our modified regular board meeting schedule for the 2021 school or 21 year, almost said school year. And that is to accommodate industry meetings moving the following meetings. Okay. Does anybody have anything to add to that or discuss?
So, Mr. President, is my voice coming through or am I breaking up?
Oh, you're coming through, Randy.
Okay, well, I would move that we approve the modified regular board meeting schedule for calendar year 2021 as proposed to accommodate industry meetings moving the following meetings, June 7, 2021 to June 1, 2021, June 1, 2021, that's hard to say, to June 14, 2021. All meetings to be held at the headquarters of the room 327 North Wenatchee Avenue, Wenatchee, Washington, and all committees at 8 a.m. unless further modified by any future board action.
We have a second?
I'll second the motion.
Do we have any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, now we're on to follow up on delegation of action items from prior meetings. Steve?
We did not have any action items from a prior board meeting. We have a few items from the board workshop. I did want to let the board know that we have submitted our votes to PPC, and per resolution, Liz Green has been included in our list of folks that we are recommending to join the executive committee. And the bylaws changes are scheduled to be addressed at the annual meeting, which will occur in a month, and the PUD gets one vote for the annual meeting. And the representative will need to be designated for that. Normally I would be that representative. And there's not really any additional information beyond what we discussed at the board workshop. Any questions about that?
Steve, would this be the appropriate time to nominate you as that representative, or do you need a nomination?
I don't need a nomination. We just send it in. So, and that's the way we've done it in the past. And I'll be honest that I've got a conflict that day, so I might be delegating someone else from our staff as well to be our participant.
And delegation of action items today.
Rebecca and I did not capture anything from today. Did we miss anything?
I don't believe so. Commissioners, any action items from today? So at this point, we'll be opening up the phone lines for additional public comment. Rebecca, do we have anybody that signed in?
I don't have great visibility on who has signed in.
Okay. So members of the public are encouraged to ask specific questions today. Do we have anybody to address the commissioners or speak to any item? Hearing none, do we have any other matters of general business as may be necessary coming before the commission today? Okay, I've heard none. We will not be going into executive session. Do we have anything else, Steve or Rebecca?
We don't have anything from here.
Okay. So the close the meeting today at 1:39 p.m.